My name is Einat Wilf, and this is the We Should All Be Zionists podcast. Each week, I'll be reading one essay from my latest collection of essays book, We Should All Be Zionists, on issues facing the Jewish people and Israelis today: conflict, peace, religion, politics, past, present, and future. At the end, I'll be joined by columnist Blake Flayton for a discussion on the themes of the essay and how they apply to contemporary Israel and Jewish life. You can purchase your own copy of We Should All Be Zionists anywhere you get your books. Thanks for listening. Let's start. Israel's Final Border. Essay from Mosaic, June 2020. Israel is near the end of a long journey to set its permanent borders. That's what the annexation debate is really about. Israel is near the end of a long-term journey to set its final borders. The current discussion about a possible Israeli decision to extend its sovereignty over some territories west of the Jordan River, also known as annexation of parts of the West Bank, should be understood in this context. What's going on now is less about the grand reckoning between competing visions of the Jewish state that some portray it as. It's really more about the setting of Israel's last frontier. At its birth in 1948, Israel did not have a single settled border, except perhaps with the non-belligerent Mediterranean Sea. Having failed in war to prevent the Jews of the land from attaining independence in the land, Israel's Arab neighbors refused to accept their failure. Rather than peace, the most they were willing to concede was a ceasefire in an ongoing war. Thus, the agreements negotiated to end the Arab-Israeli War of 1948 were specifically designated ceasefire agreements, meant to provide the Arab side with an opportunity to regroup in order to resume the war against the young state at a later stage, which they attempted and failed to do several times in subsequent years, failing most spectacularly in 1967. After 1949, Israelis proceeded to build their country within those ceasefire lines, but acting as if they were borders did not make them so. Neither does the act of referring to the 1948 ceasefire lines as the pre-1967 borders. Israel's Arab neighbors did not recognize them as borders. Israel did not have an internationally recognized border for three decades, until at last the southern border was finalized in the 1979 peace treaty with Egypt. Attaining its next internationally recognized border to its east with Jordan took another 15 years. It was in 1988 that Jordan renounced its claim to the territory on the west bank of the Jordan River in the context of the Oslo process. Jordan signed a peace agreement with Israel in 1994. Israel's borders with Egypt and Jordan remain to date its only internationally recognized bilaterally agreed upon borders. But it does have some other borders that enjoy some, if lesser, legitimacy and recognition. To the north, Israel's border with Lebanon reflects the old line between the British and French mandates, as well as the 1949 ceasefire line. This ostensible border gained greater international legitimacy in 2000 when Israel ended its 18-year war in Lebanon by retreating to this line, and when both sides agreed that the United Nations blue line, as delineated by UN cartographers, would be respected by both sides. Another retreat from Gaza in 2005 further contributed to setting Israel's border to the south. Although the Gaza disengagement was conducted unilaterally, Israel did take pains to fully retreat to the lines of the 1949 ceasefire known as the Green Line. The agreement signed in November 2005 between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, which then ruled Gaza, served to place some additional international legitimacy on this line. The last border to gain some measure of legitimacy is in the Golan Heights, were 38 years after Israel's official annexation of the territory in 1981, it was officially recognized as Israeli territory by the United States in 2019. These processes have also ended, for all intents and purposes, the domestic debate within Israel about its borders. The borders with Egypt, Jordan, and Lebanon are settled and are no longer disputed. The Gaza border has nearly the same status. However much some people still resent Israel's removal of the Jewish settlements there or consider disengagement from Gaza a mistake, there is no constituency for reoccupying it. Likewise, Syria's descent into civil war, the Iranian presence there, and the American recognition of Israel's sovereignty have all but ended the Israeli domestic debate about whether to keep the Golan Heights. All that remains is to finalize in one way or another the last unresolved section of Israel's eastern border, the part that was not determined in its peace treaty with Jordan. The Palestinians have for decades now made it clear that they will not sign a bilateral agreement with Israel to set this border, as they remain committed to an Arab Palestine from the river to the sea. Meanwhile, Gaza has been transformed into a Hamas-ruled rocket base. Because of these two factors, certain parameters for setting this final section of the border now enjoy wide agreement within Israel. The Israel Defense Forces will remain the only military power west of the Jordan River. The Palestinians will have some form of self-rule in some part of that territory, and Israel will do its utmost to avoid removing settlers. The reasons for each element of the consensus just articulated are also easy to understand. For most Israelis, military withdrawal from the West Bank altogether is too great a security risk. Annexing the entire territory of the West Bank would bring a mass Palestinian population into the State of Israel, which would endanger Israel's future. And removing settlers en masse would provoke social and political turmoil that is simply not worth the exchange for anything less than full and true peace. The current American peace plan comprehends this Israeli consensus and therefore appeals to the large Israeli center. It establishes the Israel Defense Forces as the only military force west of the Jordan River. It provides a pathway for Palestinians with limited political self-rule to establish a state of their own on 70% of the territory of the West Bank, and it does not entail the removal of settlements. For most Israelis, this is good enough, especially if it is supported by the U.S. and even provides a basis for further normalization with Arab states. By effectively placing a ceiling on Israel's settlement project in the form of an official map that sets aside more territory for the Palestinians than they currently control, the American plan brings Israel one step closer in the long and messy process of determining the last section of its eastern border. While this ceiling is much higher and allows more settlement than some on the left think is wise or desirable, it is much lower and allows much less than what is envisioned by some on the right. Indeed, there are settlers who believe that the ceiling envisioned in the American plan will actually prove to be a floor, a point of departure for further settlement activity in the future. Defenders of this view believe that the current proposal to extend sovereignty to less than the totality of Area C is wise, even though doing so would mean providing hitherto unheard of settler legitimacy to the idea of a Palestinian state. Why? Because they think Palestinian rejectionism is bound to yield ever more opportunities to extend Israeli sovereignty over even more territory, while in the process ensuring that a Palestinian state will never emerge. Other settlers are, on the other hand, concerned that this ceiling will actually prove less favorable to their cause, as the settler enclaves it creates inside the Palestinian state will become even less practically tenable to defend than they are today. Mainstream Israelis, this faction of settlers predicts, will therefore increasingly wonder why such isolated enclaves are necessary, and why Israel needs to extend its eastern border by hundreds of kilometers in a winding mess just to include a small number of settlers within its sovereign territory. Though I suspect that the current range of plans will place a ceiling on Israel's settlement project, and that over time they will lead to an improved and less winding border as the settlement enclaves become untenable, there is no sure way of knowing right now which dynamic is more likely to play itself out. That lack of clarity is the main reason most Israelis prefer the current status quo and do not understand why they're being troubled by the prospect of annexation at this time. As Israel moves a little bit closer to finalizing the last section of its eastern border, the process is bound to prove messy. It will not have the neat finality of a bilateral agreement with an established state as it did with Egypt and Jordan. It will not provide the clarity of a strategic retreat to a demarcated line as with Lebanon and Gaza. It will not offer the moral and political simplicity of annexing territory that is of clear strategic value and that lacks a civilian population as it did with the Golan Heights. But it will be an answer to the decades-long question nonetheless. We should therefore not mistake debates over how best to answer that question for some great moral conflict over the future of Israel. What's happening is neither a descent into one-state apartheid, as some on the left contend, nor is it the beginning of salvation, as some of the right argue. We are in the final stretches of a process that establishes the state of Israel as a permanent state in the region with recognized borders. Nothing more, but also nothing less.
Einat, I wanted to read this piece today because, of course, I think a centerpiece of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been borders.
Yes.
And the fact that some people think the dispute is over where the borders are, when in actuality it's about the borders existing, bare none in existence whatsoever, with a Jewish sovereign state inside of them. That is the root of the conflict. That is the problem. And you make a distinction in this piece that I think is very important for people in the Israel space to understand your ideology. And also, I think the thinking of a lot of Knesset members and thought leaders in the Israel space. And that is that Israel will demarcate a final eastern border, as in and who's out, where settlements can be, where they can't be. There's a ceiling, as you describe it here. But there is no military presence other than Israel's west of the Jordan River. And that confuses people because they say, well, wait a minute. If Israel is occupying this area because it's not in Israel's sovereign borders, then isn't the conflict going to persist? And then another addition to that is the objection to the idea that there can be an occupation without settlements seems to contradict enough of Israel's security establishment, who tends to think that settlements are a necessity in order to carry out, let's say, raids in different parts of the West Bank where there's terrorist activity, or managing checkpoints properly, managing arrests, the facets of an occupation. They say we need settlements there because they actually bolster our security and make our functioning possible. What would you say to the idea that if there is an occupation, it's going to prolong the conflict regardless? And also that there really can't be a thing. It's not really realistic to have an occupation without settlements.
So I think, I don't know if we wrote it in English or it was only in Hebrew, but Shani Moore and I wrote about the three models of military and civilian presence of Israel in the territories. And we talked about the Gaza model, which literally blew up in our face. And we talked about it as a failed model, a model where the army left and the civilians left. So there was no military control, there was no occupation, and there was no civilian presence. There were no settlements. And we know that the lack of a military presence enabled a massive buildup of Gaza to become what some military experts call the most fortified place in military history. So that's a failed model where there's no military at all. Again, it's a failed model as long as the Palestinians continue to be devoted to the destruction of the Jewish state. It's not a failed model if they decide that they want to live in peace next to the Jewish state. But as long as they are a people committed to our destruction, removing the military is a failed model. Then we spoke about the disengagement from the Northern West Bank, which not a lot of people are familiar with.
Which also happened in 2005.
Exactly. That was actually a success. It left the military, but there were no civilians in the Northern West Bank. And for many, many years, this led to a general calm until really in many ways the settlers renewed the efforts there. So the idea of military presence, but not civilian one, was one that worked well for quite a few years. And then we have the model in the rest of the West Bank, which is both civilian and military presence, which is also a very, you could say, combative model or one that is conducive to violence. So one thing's for sure, definitely after October 7th, no Israeli military presence in the West Bank and Gaza before the Palestinians have ended their century-long war against Zionism is not acceptable and will not be acceptable. So this is even a broader Israeli consensus than it was before, and it now extends to Gaza. So even when we wrote that the model of Gaza of removing the settlements and the military was failed, and I remember people asked me, so you're essentially saying that the military needs to go back and control Gaza. You know, it was difficult to say that, but I think now this is what the Israeli consensus will be, that the Israeli military cannot afford to have at the minimum what's called the freedom of action, the freedom of military action in Gaza. Now you're asking the other question from the other side, those who say that actually the existence of settlements contributes to Israeli security. And here I'm saying that it's not a zero or one situation. I view it more as a 30-70, where you can make good arguments where having a civilian presence helps the military operate, and you can make good arguments of the opposite, that the civilian presence actually prevents the military from focusing on what it needs to be doing, which is fighting the enemy, rather than kind of inserting itself in various settler Arab disputes or anything of the sort. So here, I don't view it as a one or zero, like settlements are clearly good for our defense or settlements are clearly bad for our defense. I see it more as a 30-70, and also I see it as a very specific case. You could actually argue that some settlements in some areas contribute to Israeli security and some of them not at all. So you don't even have to make the blanket statement, all settlements, no matter where they are. And I think this should be the governing policy going forward, that Israel looks at settlements only through the security prism and not through anything else. So that's a debate that I'm willing to have, you know, none of the biblical land, God, Messiah debate, none of like this is an impediment to peace debate. All of these are not relevant, but a more narrow prism of how do they contribute or hinder security. I think that's a more nuanced debate, and I think we need to have it literally on a settlement by settlement basis.
Right, right. I think that's true. I think people look at the settlement project as if it's this monolith, and that is entirely not the case. Not only for the difference of people who live in the settlements, I think people who live in Efrat or Ariel or students who are studying at Ariel University are quite a different ideological demographic than the people living in the wildcat settlements who are doing so for strictly religious reasons. So it's always helpful to kind of split hairs in this conversation. Borders right now are a disaster in Israel. There's hundreds of thousands of people who are away from their homes, who are displaced from their homes. It's funny how the international community doesn't, you know, describe those as refugees or as people who have been displaced from war, who need to be accommodated for immediately, because they're Jewish refugees, and they're Jewish refugees in a state that protects them, and that is the Jewish state, which can't be said of Palestinians, of course, for whatever reason. But this is a victory, I would say, for Hamas and Hezbollah, that they've essentially not legitimately shrunk because, you know, there's no moving of a line anywhere. And obviously there hasn't been an intrusion into Israeli sovereign territory since October 7th, since the massacre in the kibbutzim. But I would still say that this is a failure on Israel's part. What do you see the future being as we look forward to the summer and potentially a massive war with Hezbollah and, you know, the Rafah invasion? People say it's this week. People say it's next week, the week after. Oh, it's actually not starting until Hezbollah starts, which is an unpopular but strange, you know, and strange opinion. How do you see this shaping up? How do we bring our citizens back to their homes in really the most vulnerable part of the country?
So this really has to do a lot with the issue of borders and kind of a fundamental sense that first and foremost, our duty as a country, as a military, is to defend our borders, is to defend our citizens. And this, of course, has been the greatest failure on October 7th because it was an invasion into Israeli sovereign territory, nothing disputed. As I said, the disengagement from Gaza was Israel made sure that it was to the demarcated ceasefire line so that there would be no excuses. I think Sharon underestimated the possibility of Palestinians to make up new excuses. But at the time, the notion is, okay, we're withdrawing completely. We will leave them no excuses. But absolutely, the fact that within the state of Israel, hundreds of thousands of people are displaced without a clear horizon as to how this ends, I think will make the question of borders even more acute in the sense of we want to live in a state where the borders are clear and that the army defends those borders and the citizens in those borders. Now, historically, for Israel to do that, it actually had to take the war into enemy territory. You know, sometimes people say that Israel's pre-1967 lines are indefensible. And I always like to say that those are the lines from which we always won our wars, beginning from 48 to 56 to 67. And it's actually when we are in control of territories that we have not had clear victories as we had before. So I think what we're going through right now is the reconstituting of the IDF. I think the IDF with the territories, with the settlements for many, many years became like this heavy defensive military that focused more and more on, you know, with Iron Dome and more on how like we defend and protect ourselves rather than what was the defensive position of, ironically, of the IDF, of the Israel Defense Forces before 67, which is you go on the offense. Mm-hmm. So the IDF pre-67 was a very on-the-offense military. And that's how
it could never be fought on Israeli soil.
It was tiny.
Right. It would have been impossible.
Exactly. So it was a preemptive military. It was a military that would go on the offense. And I think now we're seeing that if you become like this defensive military against armies and countries and organizations that want nothing less than your complete dissolution, then you find yourself constantly receding. So what we'll have to do is we'll have to get to a point where we have clear borders and then we have a military that defends those borders by taking the war to the enemy territory.
Right. It's sort of like there's too much to defend. There's too much to defend. And so we're not going to have those clear-cut victories that we did, and you mentioned, in 48, in 56, and 67, because even in 67, when we extended Israeli presence and triple the size of what the country had been, that was an effect of a war that was fought initially from 67 lines.
Precisely.
And having less to defend and having a clear, like, Jewish state with a Jewish majority, with no question about its sovereignty, ultimately worked out better for us, and the victories were clearer, were more obvious. My last question is, you write this piece with an optimistic tone, mm-hmm. that Israel is in the final stretches of mm-hmm. demarcating its final eastern border. Is that still the case, not only in a post-October 7th world, where questions of security are no doubt about to get louder and arguments over what to do about it are no doubt about to get louder, but also because of this government who may fall this year, but whose voter base, who fundamentally believes in the same thing as some of the more radical parties in the Knesset, those people are not going away. So are you still optimistic? When was this piece written? This was in 2020, so it's 4 years later.
So in the piece, I draw a very long timeline. I basically go from 1948-49 to 2020 and showing how bit by bit, and sometimes the bit is 25 years, right? So from 49 to 79, that's 30 years until we have our first border. And then another 15 years until we have our second border. And that, so I show how these are long processes and how even with the Syria and Lebanon and Gaza, where I said they're not borders, but they're getting there, you know, they have a bit more legitimacy, a bit more finality. So I draw it as a very long process. So I still think we are in the midst of this process. I also talk about the fact that this is going to be a messy process. It's not going to be neat. That precisely because the last undetermined border is at the core of the Judean heartland, at you know, the security issues there are the most acute.
In the Jordan Valley.
The Jordan Valley, the mountaintops overlooking Tel Aviv and our airport. So precisely a lot of the issues are so acute there that I said in the essay, I don't think this is going to be like a pleasant process. It's going to be messy, and messy and is another word in our region, too violent and bloody. So I do think in many ways that's what's going on. How long it will take until this will be a more settled border, one where it's clearer who's in, who's out. I don't know, but what we're going through is part of it.
And I lied. I do have a final question because I think it's helpful to be specific. What are the settlements that we can say off the bat? Of course, those are going to be included in Israel. Just so our right-wing listeners, who I get DMs from you all the time, and I'm addressing your concerns, What do we mean by settlements and the settlements that are not going to be in Israel and the settlements that are going to be part of Israel?
So I once wrote an essay, I think I might have translated, but it was in Hebrew. Because I'm a great proponent of specificity all around, I actually went around and named them. Mm-hmm. So it's generally the ones that are around Jerusalem, in Gush Etzion, near Bethlehem. They're essentially the ones that are adjacent to the Green Line, to the 1949 ceasefire line, maybe some in the Jordan Valley as well. So those are the ones that are clearly in. And then the more into kind of the heartland of the territory you go, the more it raises a question mark. If you look at the map of the Trump peace proposal, then it basically includes all of them, but includes them in like little enclaves. And that's an option too that you can look into. But at the end of the day, the ones that are really, really, there's a question about, my guess is they are only home to 20% of the settlers. Because
I think even less.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, about 70-80% of the settlers live in the settlements that are adjacent to the Green Line, and no one disputes that.
Right. Okay. I double lied. I do have a final question. I'm sorry. We have time, though. What would you say to the argument, because going off the first question where we talked about there will be an occupation, and we have discussed before how occupation is legal under international law, because that's how states decide the borders in peacetime that were created during wartime. But what do you say to people who make the comparison that if this occupation continues and there's limited Palestinian sovereignty, as you wrote in the chapter, what is the difference between that and South African Bantustans, where there was limited sovereignty, basically completely on ethnic lines, and there was still a fair amount, if not complete, state control over those enclaves, as we've called them here before, those Palestinian enclaves, which, you know, in regard to an occupation, it might entail limited movement. It might entail limited trade, limited movement, not just internally, but externally. Which countries can you go to? Like, Gaza doesn't have an airport, et cetera. And how, I think it's helpful to put a, what the Palestinians must do in this situation as well. It's not just Israel's drawing its final border. If this occupation continues, I don't think it can continue for another 50 years. And also at the same time, aren't Palestinians incentivized then to just do nothing? Because, oh, if these are just Bantustans, if these are just places where we have limited sovereignty, the international community and Israeli society itself is not going to be able to deal with us because we're just going to keep agitating until Zionism is even more vulnerable than it is today.
So you basically answered the question about what's the difference. And fundamentally, the difference here is that there's no any kind of ideological or ethnic kind of occupation. It's quite, I mean, again, there's a substantial Arab minority within the state of Israel. It's because the Arabs have waged a relentless, nonstop, total war for the non-existence of Jewish sovereignty in any part of the land. It's part of what drives me crazy so much in this conflict is the reversal of cause and effect, mm-hmm. where people say, oh, the occupation is the result, is the occupation is the reason for the violence. That's a bit of what you refer to in your question, when people say, because of the occupation, the Palestinians are engaging in violence and terrorism. But it's exactly the opposite.
Right.
The occupation is the outcome of repeated wars, of the Arab refusal to make peace with Israel. The reason that the occupation never came to an end, despite repeated Israeli proposals and efforts to bring an end to it with the existence of a fully sovereign Palestinian state, no settlements, capital in East Jerusalem. We talk about 2000, 2008, there were other opportunities, but every time that the Palestinians could have had their full sovereign state, they walked away and they followed it up with even more violence because their goal has only ever been no Jewish state. Their goal has never been an independent Arab-Palestinian state that lives next to the Jewish state of Israel. Their priority has always been no Jewish state. So this is a state of war. This is a state of total war. A total war declared by the Arab, and especially using the Palestinians as the spearhead, against the existence of a Jewish state. Occupation in the course of war is legal. When that war is over, when the Arabs and especially the Palestinians end their century-long war against the Jewish state, then they will have full sovereignty. And, you know, I have people writing to me, Einat, you should really promote Jordan taking the West Bank and Egypt taking Gaza. And I tell them, sure, I'm agnostic. Any sovereignty that will be responsible in the West Bank and Gaza and will not seek total war against the Jewish state, call it whatever you will, would be an acceptable sovereignty that we will be happy to live next to. We just want to make sure that that's what they want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So again, it's occupation until that point is legal and in fact moral to ensure your own survival.
Yep.
Thank you so much, Einat, for, again, interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Ma sheru mitorer, ma sheru mitorer.